Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by national security lawyer Mark Zaid, and we discuss the legal case for the victims of the so-called anonymous health instance, otherwise known as Havana Syndrome. Mark and I discuss the US government's denial and how that affects his clients who have had their lives disrupted by these alleged attacks. Just before we begin, if you're enjoying this podcast, please consider supporting us directly by becoming a Patreon subscriber. All you need to do is just go to patreon.com/secretsandspies. And depending on which level you pick, you'll get a free coaster or coffee cup. And also you'll get access to our Patreon exclusive show, Extra Shot, which comes out twice a month after every espresso martini. I hope you find this episode interesting. Thank you very much for listening. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Mark Zaid, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Appreciate the invite.
Well, it's great to have you here because I wanted to chat to you today, obviously, about these anomalous health incidents, which have been sort of catching the news and people's imaginations. But before we get into that, for the benefit of listeners, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I've been practicing law now for over three decades. I'm a New Yorker. I do have British connections, actually.
Oh, cool.
I spent a semester in college working for a member of the House of Parliament back in 1988 when Maggie was in office. It was a phenomenal experience. Guy's name was Gary Waller. Sadly, has passed away. He was up from the Lake District in Keighley, as I recall, West Yorkshire, I believe, if I remember correctly. Fantastic experience. Absolutely loved it. I also, a couple other kind of background explanations that tie me into the United Kingdom. I also handled the Pan Am 103 Lockerbie bombing. I filed the first lawsuit against the government of Libya for the bombing. Spent a little time up in Lockerbie. Wonderful, sweetest folks probably that I've met. So friendly. I also represented Mohammed Al-Fayed. And handled all of any issues relating to the death of Princess Diana and his son Dodi here in the United States for about 3 years or so. But I'm predominantly a national security lawyer. I handle cases on behalf of U.S. federal employees, particularly within the intelligence community, in the military and law enforcement communities, but especially intelligence communities. And I dive down into some really wild adventures, sort of just like this one, frankly, where there is a whole host of information that, frankly, is only visible beneath the surface, sort of like the iceberg that sank the Titanic, since we just passed the anniversary on that, because most of the evidence and what we're going to talk about today is classified. But there's enough out there that points us in a particular direction.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for all that. And through your history, I'm just hearing, oh, that could be a good podcast. That could be a very good podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Love to talk about all of those topics. Very near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's kick off. So are you able to tell us about how many clients you represent who have been victims of this anomalous health incident? And are you able to tell us a bit about sort of their backgrounds and why they would have been targeted?
I represent somewhere around two dozen victims or their family member. Well, all victims, but federal employees or their family members, because many of these incidents around the world happened in their homes. So that meant that at times their spouse, their child, sometimes even their pet was impacted at the same time, or only the family member was impacted if only that family member was home. I started on this case because this is important, because everybody talks to it about Havana syndrome. And I'd love to explain why I don't think Havana syndrome is the right term. It's not one I use. I use anomalous health incidents, AHIs. But my first case was a National Security Agency, the NSA employee, over a decade ago. And he was hit in around 1995 or six in a classified location, although I've seen one media report identify it as Moscow. And I was working right years before the incidents in Havana happened. Once Havana happened, and we started to have a greater sense that this was a bigger story than what we thought. I mean, I remember telling the NSA that, what's the problem? Why won't you cooperate with us? We're just trying to get workman's compensation. You know, injured in the line of duty for this individual. Two people were injured. One had already died. You know, it's going to be so inexpensive for you. You're not going to open up Pandora's box without understanding there actually was a Pandora's box that then opened in Havana, Cuba. And from that, I started to then represent State Department, Defense Intelligence Agency, the intel wing of the Department of Defense, the CIA, of course, the Central Intelligence Agency, Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI agents and analysts, USAID, the Agency for International Development, even the Commerce Department, because there are foreign commercial service officers. Essentially, they operate under the State Department as diplomats, but their function is to handle trade issues when they're overseas. And there were several FCOs injured in China in the aftermath of Havana in 2017, when a number of State Department and diplomatic personnel were injured in China. At least for me, I limit my representation to federal employees and their family members. The commonality, the common theme through almost all of them is that they were working on operations against Russia. Some of them appear to literally have just been mistaken identity. I have one client in China who was Foreign Commercial Service, and we could never understand, like, why would this person be hit? It doesn't make sense. Well, it made more sense when we found out that the person who occupied their apartment before them was CIA. And it was very likely that it was just a mistaken identity, and they hit the apartment without realizing that the person had moved. Or there just mightn't be explanations. I mean, some of these are going to be very difficult to, frankly, understand. And a lot of it, of course, beyond saying, yeah, Russia is the connection, what they did, their work that the clients do, particularly those who are in the intelligence community, is all classified.
Well, one of the victims named in the 60 Minutes documentary has been called Carrie. I don't think that's a real name. Can you talk to us a bit about what she experienced?
Yeah, Carrie is a domestic AHI victim, a special agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. She was based out of Key West, Florida, the bottom of the Americas, us, the United States of America, obviously not all the Americas. But the closest location to Cuba, not that that has a relation, but Key West is a huge spy environment, very well known. There's a lot of military bases down there and surveillance and satellite technology and all sorts of technological functions within the military and intel community. It's a real jumping off point for a lot of agencies. So there's a lot of activity that's down there from many different intelligence agencies. She, as she described in the 60 Minutes broadcast, underwent a number of incidents of where it is consistent with anomalous health incidents, some sort of directed energy, whatever it might be, so much so that in the midst of one, her cell phone battery case, the battery expanded and broke the case. I mean, so there are examples like that, in fact, where devices is not the first one. I have other clients that have experienced this. Devices, whether computers or other electronics, have visually demonstrated some sort of anomaly. So, right, so it's not just the person going through the experience. There's actually other evidence that this happened. Now, the beauty of her case is that while she cannot discuss anything that she worked on for the FBI as an operational aspect, and by the way, she appeared on 60 Minutes with approval, with authorization from the FBI. I arranged for that. So these are no rogue individuals who are going forth. We coordinated everything. So I knew what the limitations were. She was the only female FBI agent based down in that location. And local law enforcement arrested a Russian, and it's shown in the segment, that the local law enforcement, told 60 Minutes and others that, yeah, this individual was, when we arrested them, he had this weird technological devices that could wipe out the GPS system, all the electronics in the car. He's supposedly a chef, but he's appeared on television shows as a chef, but he's got all these records of bank transactions, tens of thousands of dollars. He's some of what they didn't show actually in the broadcast is he's sitting in the cop car because it's being filmed, right? There's a camera, not only body cams of the officers, but a camera in the car, and he's talking to himself, but on camera. And he's using all these spy terms, and he's gibberish at a lot of times, but it almost sounds like he's talking in code and sending message, like he knows what's going on. And in fact, he could have been bailed out, and he chose not to be bailed out. And it's known that he was interrogated by the FBI because the local law enforcement officers revealed that. And while we were in the midst of finding him for this broadcast, we learned literally that 2 weeks earlier, he had supposedly been killed on the front in Ukraine, that he, for whatever reason, went back to Russia after like 2 years or so, and then died. It was quite an interesting shock. Could be completely coincidental. Who knows? We don't know. But coincidences add up. So she is one of the stronger domestic cases for incidents. There are many others of federal employees, especially the FBI and CIA and State Department. But most of these are not known because almost all of them, in fact, at least all the ones I know of, they still work for the U.S. government and they just don't speak out.
Yeah. With that Russian man, is it Vitaly Kovalev? I hope I got that pronunciation right. In the 60 Minutes documentary, it kind of implied that he had a background in the GRU in electronics and so on. And it struck me as a bit odd that somebody with that background would somehow be able to get a visa to work in the States as a chef. It just seemed very weird.
There's a lot of weird things surrounding this guy. His background education, coming from those who are far more experienced on the Russian aspect than I am, as far as knowing the personnel of Russian intelligence and military intelligence, that someone trained in the manner he was, the investment that the Russians put into him, aren't going to just let him leave Russia, go to the United States, and become a chef. Hey, James Jesus Angleton, the infamous CIA spy master, he loved orchids. Right, he named orchids on the side. You can have some parallel, I'll say strange in the sense of a combination of spying and plants, botany, or spying and cooking. Maybe some people would see that as strange. The notion of participating in that, they've got hobbies. The notion that he left somehow young officer with scientific training of that nature and then just comes to the United States is from those who know their expertise of that system is just incredible to believe, with the obvious implications that this individual was sent here as essentially an illegal, if anyone has watched The Americans television show, that he was here as an illegal, involved with whatever operations beyond AHI being just one of them.
Yeah, yeah. He was a very interesting man. He just struck me instantly for his background stuff. That man's clearly a spy. Now, you sort of talked a bit about the attacks already. Is there anything else that you can add about the commonalities of the attacks? I feel like you have covered quite a lot of that.
Well, the key thing, and this was said on the 60 Minutes broadcast by Greg Edgreen, who was the senior DOD official handling AHI investigations within the Defense Intelligence Agency, is this isn't just the clerks, the secretaries, the guards at our embassies or spy bases. These are very often the top of the top that we have. These are folks who, one, would be known to the adversary, quite frankly. A lot of people in the public don't recognize how coordinated the spy game is. Yes, there are spies who the other side doesn't know of, but a lot of our spies, as I do air quotes, although they are spies, are known to the other side. I mean, either because they're literally declared as such, or it's so obvious that they are. In fact, some of the people who we believe have been hit, who were not spies, but they were with spies at the time, and they were acting in ways in which it wouldn't be surprising that the adversary would think they are spies. They were just kind of playing games and doing their own little trainings and things like that. It made them appear to be something they weren't. The adversary doesn't realize this, and boom, hits them. I will say, I think every continent but Antarctica, we have identified hits, AHI, in different locations. There are on the African continent, though those really haven't been discussed publicly, but they do exist. Most of the ones that have been publicly discussed are in Europe. We saw Frankfurt on the 60 Minutes episode. Vienna is a very huge location. Northern Virginia, the Washington, D.C. area, obviously Key West, like we've said, or Key West and Miami. Again, a hotbed of intel activity, particularly with the Russians. And it doesn't mean that there aren't other countries involved. It doesn't mean that there aren't other nationalities involved. The Russians use cutouts all the time, proxies to use other people, locals, domestics that they hire who may not even know what the heck they're involved with in doing. It's very much a big game for a lot of these. It's just a very dangerous one.
No, indeed. And this has been going on a lot longer than we've known about. So you said, was it 1995?
Yes. So here's my working theory, and this is the theory. I believe this goes back decades. Now, in saying that, one has to understand, what does that mean? Do you mean like we've never known about diplomats being hit with these whatever weapons? No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the technology, for one, has been since the 50s. Whether it's microwaves, radio frequencies, RFs, I'm not sure what word you put on after frequency, because probably redundant to say radio, yeah. RF frequencies, but whatever, this directed energy, and I imagine it could take the form of multiple types. I'm not an expert in that type of technology, but microwaves, let's just use it as that, or directed energy. For one thing, back in the 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s, but 60s and 70s in particular, we had what's called the Moscow signal. There's no speculation about this. This is something that is very well documented, admitted. The Soviets admitted it. The U.S. government has admitted it. There's countless documents online. You can just look up by Googling Moscow signal. And it was that the Soviet Union was bathing the U.S. Embassy in Moscow with low-level microwaves. And we didn't know why. I'm not sure we know why. I don't know if the public record says it. The suspicion was, especially based on other things we know, that this was setting off technology that was hidden within the embassy. You know, the famous situation where the Soviets gave us a U.S. seal, an eagle for the ambassador to hang in his office, which he did for like 7 years. And it turns out there was a listening device in that. But it was a specialized listening device that we had not seen before that was energized, engaged by radio frequencies or microwaves, I forget which, that would turn it on. And that type of technology was being used. The U.S. government, or the U.S., somewhere in the U.S., we invented it initially in the 50s. It's clearly been worked on. You know, I'm sure all of our countries and the primary ones in the world, you know, have developed it further. So it seems that this originally started as a listening surveillance type technology, extraction of information. And in the midst of it, clearly, it became known through just even the commercial use of microwaves that it could be harmful to humans, that it has an impact on living creatures. At some point in time in the evolution of this technology, it has become weaponized. Now, where that happened is a question of intent. And that's something we don't know, right? I can take the stapler on my desk, which is clearly intended to just staple pages together, and hit you over the head and weaponize it. That's not what the intent of the device was. So at some point, and all I can point to is at least post-Havana, when the story was public and it became known that people were physically suffering, clearly, any further use of the device, whatever it might be, by whomever is doing it, they would know it's got this harmful effect, and they are weaponizing. Now, whether it's a dual purpose, that they're still extracting data from the person's cell phone, or they intend to hurt the person, right? Who knows? When we get a defector, when we grab some more documents, I'm sure at some point in time, we will learn. But you know, there were public congressional hearings in the late 70s about the Moscow signal. And at one point, I think he was either the Secretary of State or the National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger, went over to the Soviet Union and told his counterpart, cut it out, because they believed the U.S., that the ambassador to the Soviet Union had died because of the microwaves, you know, that it had contributed to leukemia or cancer that he had developed. And that's in the 1970s.
Yeah. Wow. I've heard it's become reasonably common that members of US staff who have worked in Moscow have suffered some sort of symptoms after working in the embassy. I don't know if it's necessarily cancerous, but something because of the microwaves projected at the embassy.
There have been, and this has not been really publicly reported because it's anecdotal, but it's, so for me, let's say it's, I guess it's probably third hand by this time, where a number of the CIA officials who have served in Moscow in the last decade, either they or their spouses have developed rare, cancer. Mm. That could be completely coincidental, right? I don't know. What I've continually said, especially because the congressional hearing back in the 70s, one of the questions they asked of the U.S. government, the members of Congress, was, are there long-term health effects? And the response was, we don't know. Not enough time has passed. Well, that was like 1979. Enough time has passed. How about checking to see senior State Department, senior CIA staff who served in Moscow in the 60s and 70s? Wouldn't be hard to figure out who it was. Are they still alive? I'm sure quite a number of them have died just by the passage of time. What did they die of? Is there an increased proportional percentage-wise of Parkinson's, leukemia, breast cancer, whatever it might be? I've heard, again, anecdotal, that there is a Parkinson's working group, a support group inside the CIA. Doesn't surprise me that that would exist, but I'm told it's a very large group, like a group that is statistically significantly larger than what would be present in the general public environment.
Wow.
Is there a reason for that? Right? I mean, these are very basic questions that I think could go to answer and maybe refute, you know, some of what we're saying by way of claims. But the fact that the U.S. government is not, to my knowledge, undertaking these studies, these examinations, is part of why I say there was or is a cover-up.
Well, let's take a quick break, and then we'll be right back. Well, there are some people who have been saying that these AHI symptoms could be psychosomatic. So with what you've seen, what would you say to that?
I would say these people are literally delusional, naive, yeah, or have an agenda. Because it's absolutely ridiculous. Now, I cannot, and I would not, say that there is not an impact of somatic thinking on people. We see it in everything.
Yeah.
The extent of it, to explain it, is where I say this is just absolutely ludicrous to think. For one thing, we've had countless people report these incidents completely independent from one another. They had no knowledge whatsoever that this was going on anywhere else in the world, or even where they were locally. We've also had numerous minor children, including infants, who have experienced the same type of symptoms. I mean, they're not subject to whatever the adults in the room are talking about, or even pets, which develop tumors and seizures all of a sudden. Now, do animals get that? Yeah, of course they do. How often is it that it's the owner, or they're the pet of an owner who also suffered an AHI situation? I mean, it just, to me, is for folks to just do a complete head in the sand that this explains everything. You know, like, I've represented people who were the victims of Gulf War syndrome from the first Gulf War, who had side effects of the anthrax vaccine. And, you know, we do know that there is some psychological impact on individuals. You know, stress really does create a problem. I mean, we've all gone through that. And I do not doubt that some of even my clients who believe they've suffered multiple incidents, that I don't think it's a new incident. I think it is their body reacting to whatever's going on. It's a relapse, but it seems like a new incident. You know, it's sort of like developing shingles, you know, once you've had chickenpox decades earlier. You know, it's been in your system the entire time for all the decades. Something triggered it.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for that. And obviously painting quite a horrible picture for the victims, really, having to sort of live with that and the psychological effects of that. What I would love to ask you about, you sort of touched upon it, but why do you think the U.S. government is playing this down or even trying to cover up Havana syndrome?
Yeah, so, you know, let me start with one thing that didn't mean much to me at the time, but in October of 2014, again, 2 years before Havana occurred, the NSA gave me a memo, and it was to help me with my representation of Michael Beck, my original AHI client, because we needed to show to the U.S. Department of Labor that there was a correlation between the work injury, one, that it was a work injury, which eventually NSA agreed, and then two, that there was a correlation between his development of a rare form of Parkinson's and the directed energy that we believe had impacted him decades earlier. And they gave me an unclassified memo, and it's just a few sentences long, so let me just read it. The NSA confirms that there is intelligence information from 2012 associating the hostile country to which Mr. Beck traveled in the late 1990s with a high-powered microwave system weapon that may have the ability to weaken, intimidate, or kill an enemy over time and without leaving evidence. The 2012 intelligence information indicated that this weapon is designed to bathe the target's living quarters in microwaves, causing numerous physical effects, including a damaged nervous system. The NSA has no evidence that such a weapon, if it existed, lawyers wrote this, by the way, and if it was associated with the hostile country in the late 1990s, was or was not used against Mr. Beck. Now, when I got that, it sort of blew my mind at the time, and I also went, well, that doesn't help me in the slightest, but wow, I can't believe you're giving me this. This is pretty wild. What does that actually mean? And it means a lot more now, obviously, since we've got all of these now reported cases. So why would the U.S. government be covering this up? And I don't say that lightly, that I believe without a doubt that the U.S. government is covering this up and lying repeatedly publicly. I have handled a number of conspiracy cases over the years, right? I rattled off a couple of them. You know, Princess Diana's death. Who killed Princess Diana? Was she murdered? Right. I have worked these cases exhaustively, usually to debunk conspiracy theories, to come up with the plausible Occam's razor explanations. The reason for why, and it's going to be one or more of certain scenarios, what could it be? Well, for one, if what we are saying is true, the Russians and maybe others have violated the age-old norm of you do not harm fellow intelligence officers, certainly not diplomatic staff, certainly not their families, that they've crossed that line to do this for whatever reason, not only around the world on foreign soil, but on our own soil. That's an act of war. And what would the reaction be? What should it be from the United States government? It's a scary thought as to what if, in fact, they have injured dozens, hundreds, maybe more of U.S. personnel, some of whom may not even know about it because maybe it was low-level microwaves that gave them cancer 25 years later, right? They wouldn't know to tie it together. That's one reason. That's a scary reason. I do believe, like we've discussed, that the U.S. government has known about this for a lot longer than it is said, and that NSA memo is one of the reasons to even show the Moscow signal, things like that. So this has been another cover-up from the American public, not just the American public, a cover-up from our diplomatic personnel who haven't been told until recently that this is a risk. And so, hey, you know, if you're going to be assigned to go to Afghanistan or Iraq, you're not going to bring your family members with you because it's a dangerous post. But if you're going to go to Vienna and Frankfurt, are you kidding me? That's a beautiful post. Or London? I mean, there are incidents not very well known that we suspect in London. You know, you're bringing your family with them. And none of these people were warned beforehand. There are a lot of people inside, especially the intelligence community, who are pissed off about that fact, that they weren't given any training or indications to be on the lookout for certain types of behavior beyond, you know, oh, I can see someone's tailing me. I can see someone came into my apartment. You know, the games that spy agencies play all the time and every day. There's also a very big financial component to it. You know, all these hundreds and maybe thousands of people who might have been injured by use of this technology by the enemy, who now have medical conditions that the U.S. government needs to take care of. So what's the liability for the United States? There's also a scary notion of, you know what? We can't defend our people. What are we supposed to do? We're going to give everyone some sort of surveillance detection device for microwaves. They do exist. But I mean, that's not going to work. First of all, that's an expense. Second of all, that's sort of a discomfort and an inconvenience. And also, you can't put it on our spies because that's going to be a giveaway if they get caught. Oh, look, you've got a microwave detection device on you because you're a spy, right? So that's not going to work. And what are you going to do? You're going to set it up in every family member's home, wherever they are around the world? It's not feasible. So that is also another factor with it. I mean, you know, ironically, where I think this needs to go ultimately is I think we need to literally go to the United Nations and get a treaty about the use of energy against human beings in the same way we have for nuclear weapons, chemical and biological weapons. Now, which doesn't mean that there can't be obviously benign, positive use like nuclear, right? Clearly we have great uses of nuclear energy, and we also have very horrific uses of it. The horrific ones are banned. The beneficial ones are set up in a way that they are, I can't think of what word I want, but, you know, monitored and you know, certain limitations, parameters for use and things like that. I think that's what we're going to need for this type of energy, whatever this is, microwaves, RF, whatever.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. How is this issue being received on both sides of the political spectrum in the US, and are there any politicians who are offering support for you or your clients?
Yeah, so it is not, in our view, a partisan issue. It is not a Republican or Democratic issue. Again, because it's historical, it has crossed the lines of every political administration, going back, I think, to the Nixon administration in the 60s. So we've got Republicans and Democrats, and it is really a CIA issue more than a White House issue. The CIA is really controlling what is known or not known about this information. In fact, we know of many examples where the CIA is withholding information, intelligence classified information, from its sister intelligence agencies. And we know that because the sister agencies tell us, you know, when we make it known to them of certain information, it's like, hey, by the way, my client has seen this document. Have you? No. What do you mean? We've never seen that document. How would we not have seen that document? Go ask your CIA. I mean, it happens very often. It's very disingenuous. Now, there have been some politicians who have made it political. We are seeing that a little bit more lately because of the fact that this is Russia in our sights. So quite frankly, the MAGA crowd, the Make America Great crowd, is seizing on that to say, oh, all we're doing is trying to attack Trump. Russia, 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 as Jan Brady said on the Brady Bunch. But it is Russia. It has nothing to do with Trump. We've never made it about Trump. We're not going to make it about Trump. The Trump administration was at fault, just like the Biden administration and the Obama administration and the Bush administration. Most of these, a great number of these incidents actually have taken place on the Biden administration's watch, both Obama, Trump, and Biden. Crosses the threshold. And Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, Republican senator, he actually believes that he's been hit with an AHI. Marco Rubio, Republican, has been very outspoken about this, although he's been more aligned towards the Cuban angle of it. But then Senator Warner from Virginia, where the CIA is located, has been a little bit more hesitant to go after this. Mike Turner on the House Select Committee on Intelligence, Republican chair, has been very outspoken. They have an active investigation, formal investigation. So we're doing our best not to make this political, and hopefully most people will stay away from that. But there are aspects of it where people who have agendas that are contrary to what we're trying to achieve have been trying to make it as to look as such. But it's not.
Yeah. Sadly, inevitable, especially in today's political climate. But
yes.
But there we go. So what is the goal for your clients? Is it compensation or healthcare? Or what would you like to sort of see for your clients?
So I have always told my clients, and I've said this publicly, that from the get-go, when I started on this case 10, 12 years ago, I have five primary objectives. And quite frankly, it hasn't changed. The first was always to make sure that my client receives proper and timely medical care. That is at the forefront of what we need to secure for these victims. The second is that we make sure the U.S. government pays for this medical care, because a lot of them are having to go out of pocket to private health care, particularly because they didn't realize what had happened at the time, or the U.S. government has taken too long to provide them treatment, or the U.S. government is not giving them sufficient treatment. The third aspect depends on the client, is to make sure this doesn't impact unfairly their job. And that could depend on, for example, if they're suffering significantly some sort of medical debilitating condition and they can't perform their work, I can't do anything about that. We'll need to get them some sort of medical disability or a reasonable accommodation under the law. But if they're being stigmatized for being an AHI victim, then that is something I can jump in on to try and ensure the AHI component of their situation doesn't negatively impact their career. The fourth objective is the catch-all sort of kitchen sink. I deal with Congress. I deal with the media. I do podcasts like this. We promote what the story is. We spread the news to get people interested. The 60 Minutes piece, obviously. Congressional investigations. I do a lot of Freedom of Information Act, FOIA litigation, to get documents out from the U.S. government so we can get more evidence. Everything that would push forward and advance what we're trying to accomplish. When I first started, the fifth and final objective was so far off that I wasn't even paying attention to it, and that is the compensation component. Because there wasn't anything really to do. There was no lawsuit to bring against the United States. There's immunity issues. There's civil service problems with respect to what the law is. I didn't really have anything other than FOIA, but that's just document collection, and I don't need the victims to do that. I represent journalists to get the FOIA lawsuits going. And I didn't believe it was, I still don't, that it was Cuba. I could have sued Cuba for it. Cuba does not have sovereign immunity in the United States, actually because of legislation I helped draft to go after Libya for the bombing of Pan Am 103, to take sovereign immunity away from terrorist states. But Russia has immunity, like every other country in the world, in the United States, except for domestic incidents. There are exceptions for that. But I do not have, while I could bring the case, I do not have, in my view, sufficient proof yet to say Russia did it. So I'm not ready to bring that lawsuit. Ultimately, Congress passed the Havana Compensation Act. Now, that does allow for compensation to AHI victims. It is narrow. It is being arbitrarily and inconsistently applied from agency to agency. It could have been written a lot better. Unfortunately, we're still waiting for the Defense Department and the Justice Department to actually even implement the DAMN Act, which is absolutely ridiculous. But there is at least an angle for compensation. I will say, I've told clients this, I've always been uncomfortable with the compensation angle because I represent so many military personnel who have been injured in the line of their duty. You know, they've suffered injuries from an IED explosion in Iraq or Afghanistan. They don't get compensation. Why don't they get compensation? You know, sure, they get medical care through the Veteran Affairs system for the rest of their life, but it takes a long time to get an appointment. It's not the best system in the world at all. But they don't get any medical, they don't get any monetary compensation. I had a moral issue with it, but hey, the Congress, in their infinite wisdom, passed the legislation. So I'm going to take advantage of it for my clients. And we've been getting some of the clients' compensation in the realm of about $150,000. And some of them have been denied, and we're going to look into some litigation to challenge that denial for it. But ultimately, there's going to need to be more compensation, particularly with respect to cover medical care. There's a gap, without a doubt. And so there's going to need to be more money created, maybe in the way of like a 9/11 compensation fund that was created, or an Agent Orange fund, something like that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, healthcare is not cheap in America.
No, not at all. And while the military, the Defense Department, of course, has experts about traumatic brain injuries, which a lot of these AHI victims suffer, it's a type of traumatic brain injury that they're not really used to seeing.
Mm.
You know, they're used to seeing an IED go off and knowing what a shockwave is going to do. And while there are obviously similarities, especially for the treatment, there's a lot we don't know about brain injuries just overall. So, you know, we can't detect it oftentimes. So that's one of the problems, of course, in this case is there's no real tests you can do like a COVID test to see, do you have COVID or do you have the flu? You know, there's no AHI test. There are certain things that we can look at, the doctors can look at, and if you get to the person early enough, so there was a National Institute of Health study that came out recently in the Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, that said, hey, we looked at 80 or so AHI victims, and we looked at all these non-AHI victims, and we couldn't discern any significant difference between their brain scans. Well, yeah, I could have told you that going into the testing. And what's disingenuous about it, doctors who are on the study, is that you knew this too, because you, at least two of the doctors, were involved in treating AHI victims and diagnosing them with traumatic brain injuries, because they know or knew that, or should have known, some legal terminology there, that if you don't get to these victims within a short period of time, the whatever is visible on their brain scans dissipates. And it doesn't mean the injury is gone, but the physical ability to see it dissipates and you don't see it anymore. And they know that. And I am told, since so many of my clients were in this study, that there are a number of people that people were in meetings. I've talked to people who were in meetings who were shown brain scans of victims who were examined in within days of their attack. And you see it in their scan like, holy cow, this person, their world has been literally rocked by something.
Yeah.
But you don't see that in the article.
No. Well, thank you very much for that. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up today?
You know, this is a case that is still in its infancy. I have told all of my clients whenever they first come to me that this is going to be a long-term project. And we're going to have a lot of hills and valleys, ups and downs. Mm. Right now, we are in a great momentum, probably the strongest and the best that I have seen in the dozen or years that I have worked on this case. Because now we've got actual evidence linking Russia to these incidents, and evidence that we know the U.S. government either can develop on its own, should have developed on its own, has developed on its own. And ultimately, we're going to break through that classification wall. I will say the one question that has always perplexed me is, if this is being done to us, why isn't it being done to our allies, especially the Five Eyes, right? Mm. The Brits, the Australians. Mm. I've heard rumors, anecdotal evidence of incidents against Americans in Australia, in London, but not of to Brits, to Australians, to Germans, to French. I'm curious about that. Now, the systems are different, obviously, right? In England, you've got the Official Secrets Act. It's a lot more consequences for people to come forward. Obviously, the other Commonwealth countries, similar. I don't know about with France or Germany, but that does raise a question to me. I have seen some of the naysayers say, well, if Russia has this, why haven't they used it on the battlefield in Ukraine? Well, that would kind of defeat the entire purpose of using it as a spy device, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
If all of a sudden 2,000 Ukrainian soldiers fall down, victimized by microwaves, sort of like in the same notion of when first President Bush told Saddam Hussein, you better not use anthrax or any biological or chemical weapons, because we're going to know ultimately, eventually, and we're going to retaliate. So, you know, we'll see how this develops. I think that's a deflecting theory to say, oh, why isn't it being used here? I think there are at least good faith, reasonable explanations. But we are still at the beginning of this story, even though this story has many chapters that have already been written. And it's podcasts like this to keep this conversation going so that we can gain and gather additional evidence. And unfortunately, I think quite a number of U.S. senior government officials are going to find themselves having been on the wrong side of history. And they're going to really have egg on their face, and it's going to be self-inflicted.
Is there anything listeners can do to help you or your clients in any way?
You know, it's always tough, for those who are in the United States to make mention to their members of Congress, to ask their members of Congress what their view is on this. Are they taking any steps to gain, to push forward, to gain access to information? You know, around the world, even to just to talk to journalists in all the other countries to look at. I'm going to be doing some Australian news, some German news. There is interest around the world because, quite frankly, the technology, even though maybe it hasn't been used against others, we don't know, like I said, but it can be. The technology is there. And I'm sure all of our countries have it, both offensive and defensive. The question is it being used? But this is probably going to be increasingly cheaper technology, more sophisticated as technology evolves. It is, as that NSA memo that I read, right now, undetectable unless it's on, right? It doesn't leave a trace or a path that I'm aware of in its wake. That you can, you know, take like a Geiger detector and go, there was uranium here. Oh, there were radio frequencies. I mean, there's radio frequencies all around us, right? What we're doing right now, obviously. So all of that is going to be really problematic. But, you know, I think it's ask questions of what we call the fourth estate in the media, but ask questions of your government, wherever you might be. You know, what is this technology? Does it exist? Is it being used? Are we using it? Is it being used against us?
Well, the technology sounds deeply disturbing. And as you're saying, it is going to probably progress and become smaller. So I think your idea of going to the UN is probably the answer for all of this, isn't it?
I don't see how else it could be addressed, because it really isn't just going to be an American issue. I mean, here it is. If we were attacked in Vienna and Frankfurt, all right, well, that's on German soil. It shouldn't be allowed in that capacity, even if it wasn't used against Germans, same way. Or the Russian attacks on British soil of its dissidents with the plutonium, clearly in violation of not only British domestic law, but international law. There needs to be consequences for that. The only way that's going to happen is most likely from an international convention.
Mark, where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
Well, either through my out-of-date website, markzade.com, or more likely, if you just go and look up on Twitter, where I'm at Mark S. Zaid, Z-A-I-D, Z-A-I-D, E-S-Q, Mark S. Zaid, E-S-Q.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for your time and for joining me today. It was a really interesting conversation, I think, we had there.
My pleasure.
Listening. This is Secrets and Spies.